Oh, the music isn't playing? I don't get to hear
it. I put the music in later.
The Toncast! Toncast! I mean,
you can listen to it if you want.
No, that's okay. I'm all right. So, hi, how you doing?
I'm all right.
Very good. It's been a while since we've seen each other.
Yeah, it has been a while.
So, I guess I should introduce myself.
Yeah, you have to, because you're the host of the show.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, welcome to the Toncast. I'm Eric Jones, and I'm hosting this week's program. And a very special guest today. I know you guys have been wondering who our guest would be, and it is the one and only Todd Robert Anderson.
Hey, Eric, how's it going? Oh, thanks. Hey. Applause is so nice.
Yeah, well, you know, you earned it.
Thanks so much.
So I get this phone call last week. Todd's like, hey, or I guess it was a text message. Hey, you want to do my podcast?
Yeah.
Or can I be on your podcast, I guess?
Yeah.
And so I had no idea that you even had a podcast. So, or that I have.
I don't think you're alone in that.
Yes.
I think a lot of people don't know.
Nice. But so then I started thinking, well, what the heck would we talk about?
Yeah.
Because dead air doesn't work so well on podcasts.
That's bad radio.
What I've understood.
It's bad radio.
Yeah, exactly.
Dead air is bad radio.
Bad.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I started thinking, well, our meeting was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember where we met? When we met? What happened?
We met at a film festival, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The California Independent Film Festival.
Right. In the Bay Area, right?
Northern California-ish. Maybe Central California.
I thought it was outside of... It was near San Francisco, yeah?
Sure.
Somewhere, like out in
Absolutely.
The suburbs. Yeah, something.
Yes. I know that it was up north somewhere.
And Northern, Don Wells was there.
And Don Wells was there, which is... yeah, that was an interesting... So, first of all, in my memory of our meeting, I went up to you and I said something like, hey, you're the guy from Weeds. But what I think probably really happened was I went up and I said the worst thing ever, worst thing that you could possibly say to an actor like yourself. You look really familiar. What do I know you from?
Yeah, that's classic.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I get that a lot. Yeah.
And I unfortunately have a feeling that I said that.
Yeah. My other favorite thing is when people go, hey, I saw you in that commercial. And I go, okay. Great.
You just say thank you?
No.
No.
For what?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. For acknowledging that you saw me.
You were watching TV at the moment.
Hey, I saw you down at the post office. Do you go, thank you?
Well, thanks.
No,
yes.
You don't. No. You go, okay. Cool. Yeah. So you watch TV. So we've got Matt out.
There you go.
So I know that.
Out of the way.
Yeah. That's
very
great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. So yeah, Don Wells.
Yeah.
So do you remember the night where we had the conversation with her?
I surely do.
Yes. That was a
very memorable evening.
So for those of you in podcast world that don't know who Don Wells is, she played Marianne on Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm. Great show. And about a bunch of people who went on a 3-hour tour.
Yes.
And wound up on a deserted island.
I guess it's probably
somehow
a good thing that you told people, because today's generation might not
they
know
might
what
not
Gilligan's
know
Island
that.
Is.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It was Lost before Lost.
Right.
It was Survivor before Survivor.
Yes. And every week there would be a new guest star.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember one episode, it was like the Harlem Globetrotters. Like some different person or group of people would
Random.
Get shipwrecked every week with the Gilligan crew. And then they'd get out off the island.
And
they
the
would
Gilligan
never send in. Anybody to rescue the idiots on the island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the professor, though, he was able to make communication devices and cars and all sorts of other stuff via the coconuts and things on the...
On the bamboo, yeah.
On the bamboo.
And the classic, you know, critique of the show is if he could build a radio out of bamboo, why couldn't he fix that tiny-ass hole in the side of the boat?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
The 3-hour tour.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's been a raging debate forever and ever and ever, since the show came out, I guess, as to... Who would you rather be with? Ginger or Marianne.
Right. It's sort of, it's like, it's the virgin whore complex.
A little bit.
What it is, I think.
And
I know Dawn Wells was saying it was...
Who played Marianne.
Yeah. She said that Marianne's the girl you would want to marry.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. The virgin.
Sure. Marianne wasn't a virgin.
No, but that
buy
was
it
her.
For a second.
And then she said that Ginger was the slut.
You're right.
And so most guys would be wanting to, they would want Marianne because she was the nice girl that you could take home to mom. And they would just, like, fantasize about being with the slut.
Right.
And this sounds like just a very simple conversation that could have taken, you know, 2.5 minutes and we could be done with it.
Right.
That's not my recollection.
No, it went on for hours. She was, like, belligerent.
Yes. She got
with
to
us because we, I mean, there was definitely a generational gap that she was not getting.
Yeah.
Where those of us who are, you know, middle-aged types, as opposed to, how old is she, like 70 or something like that?
Probably.
Yeah. So there was a generation gap, but she didn't believe any of us when we said, no, I would totally marry Ginger. I don't want to marry a virgin.
Right.
I want to marry someone who knows what she's doing in the sack.
Someone who's had some experience.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that just, she called us all liars, said we were full of shit.
The thing that I tried to, you know, because here we are, we're all drunk off our butts, but we're just, and I'm so, I'm kind of trying to explain to her, you know, like a sober person would explain to another sober person, even though we're both blotto. Blotto, does anybody say that anymore?
Oh, since, not since like the 1950s. That's funny. I haven't heard that word in a long time.
It's been a while.
Yeah, you see that like word in old Mad magazines, you know?
I think that's probably where I got
it.
So, but anyway, so yeah, I'm like, look, guys just don't care anymore if a girl has had a couple of lovers or had sex with, you know, however many people. It doesn't matter. As long as there's a connection, as long as, you know, we're together now.
Yeah.
I don't care what you've done.
We're a more sexually positive generation, and we don't slut shame. Right?
We don't what?
Slut shame. That's what they call it.
Yes.
When you make a woman feel bad for having had multiple sexual partners or liking sex.
Right.
At all.
Absolutely.
We don't do that. We don't shame people for that anymore.
There's this thing that, you know, that a woman's not supposed to sleep with a guy until the third date or whatever. And obviously the guy's wanting to have sex on the first date.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of stupid. And here's why.
Okay.
Because, obviously, sex is an important part to any relationship.
Yeah.
And what the woman is doing by having this waiting three dates thing is she's holding that piece of her back so that the guy won't leave.
Right.
And then what happens if she has sex with the guy after three dates and now she doesn't like the guy anymore?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems really silly. I think she should have all the power that the man has. And if she wants to have sex on the first date, have sex on the first date. And then she can find out now if she doesn't like the guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And boom.
Boom. Yeah. That's, I agree. I'm, when I was in New York in college, if you didn't sleep with her on the first date, you weren't ever going to sleep with her. That's the way it worked in New York. It was like, you knew, like, oh, I guess that didn't work. Yeah. There was none of that.
Yeah.
Waiting three didn't. Nobody did that.
Yeah.
That's maybe weird. A couple women from the Midwest would still think that way, but for the most part, it was.
Yeah. I think it's a.
You're either getting laid that night or you're never going to get laid.
Never going to see her.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, So, fast forward in our relationship.
Well, do you remember, though, that night with Dawn Wells? Do you remember the polyamorous lesbian who injected herself into our conversation?
No.
She was fascinating.
No, I don't remember.
Because she was like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to, you know, intrude, but I overheard your spirited conversation about, you know, virgins and whores and Marianne and Ginger, and she started you know, giving her opinions on that, and then started explaining, you know, to us, to Don and me about, you know, polyamory, like, and having multiple, like,
lovers.
Yeah, I mean, polyamory is, like, different than, you know, swinging.
Okay.
Because it's, you have, like, multiple committed relationships.
Okay.
Of varying degrees. Like, you'll have, like, a main, you know, husband or wife or two, you know, and then, like, maybe someone who's a little bit more casual and blah, blah, blah. And she was saying that she had just been upstairs in one of the hotel rooms making S&M porn. In a hotel room?
How do I not remember this at all?
I don't know. I don't know how, you know, and so I started asking her questions about that, you know, and then at one point, like, someone, you know, like, mentioned, like, so are you a swinger? Is that what you mean? And she's like, she got offended by the suggestion. She's like, no, I'm polyamorous. Swingers are disgusting. And I was like,
What's the difference?
Why? That is so weird. Why would you, if you're a sex positive person, why would you judge somebody else's? I was just so confused. She was a weird lady.
I don't remember that at all.
I was like, you're polyamorous, you're upstairs making BDSM porn, and you think swingers are gross? You know how crazy that sounds?
Yeah.
That was so weird.
I guess people draw the line someplace.
I don't know. I don't know.
I remember Steve Hicks, the director of Fuzz Track City, was there, and that's why you guys were at the festival, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's where I saw the movie, and I still remember something about that movie, and I don't remember stuff about movies generally. Right. I have that emotional experience. I ride that roller coaster, and then it goes away.
Uh-huh.
But I remember... one thing about that movie is the guy offered your character a drink, and what he had was mouthwash. Kinds of mouthwash.
That's so funny you bring that up, because shooting my web series Film Pigs last night with that guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't seen him in like a year.
That's funny.
But I just, you know, like you, I texted him out of the blue and said, hey, can you do this? He's like, yeah, sure. He's a funny bastard.
Dave
Florek is his name. He's a great guy. Yeah.
Nice. But anyway, so Steve then interjects. Like, he's been sitting off to the side of this Don Wells conversation the whole time.
Right.
Not wanting to get involved.
Who could blame him?
Exactly. I just was having a fun time.
Yeah,
I didn't
sure.
really care.
Yeah.
And then he gets involved, and he says to Don, you realize that you were talking about two imaginary people and an imaginary scenario of imaginary, like, none of this is real. And she, like, got really livid at that point. And it was just like, I don't remember. It was just funny. His practical, he like took the air out of the balloon completely.
Hicks is funny because he's, you know, a super nice guy and generally really supportive. But if, there are moments where he gets pushed too far.
Yeah.
And it, like, he will shut things down. It's really funny. I mean, because, like, as a director working on Fuzz Track City, I mean, that was one of my favorite stories about his direction. Like, he's in the room next door looking at monitors, and because, you know, we were shooting in this motel and it was really tight, so he can be in the room. He had to be in the next room. And so we, you know, doing the scene, and then he comes in, you know, and they have the camera's like following everybody around, you know, it's like choreographed sort of thing. And it was a scene where, you know, my estranged wife is giving birth, and, you know, Dee Wallace is there, and everybody's, it's pandemonium, but he came in after like the first take, and like his face was just, I mean, he'd had it. He was tired anyway.
Yeah.
It was a crazy shoot, and he was exhausted, and it was very stressful. But he just came in. Guys, stakes. And then just left. Like, everybody was not bringing it. That's all. That was his whole direction. Which totally worked. Then we were like, oh, yeah. And then it's just the reality got heightened for us. It was really funny. But yeah. Nice. Yeah. You can only push that guy so far.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So, Fuzz Track City is now available on Blu-ray?
Not Blu-ray, but no? DVD.
DVD?
It's DVD, and you can stream it, I think, on Amazon or iTunes or one of those places. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's out there.
Yeah.
In the cosmos.
That's good.
Yeah. It's got some nice reviews on Amazon, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
So, we were there, Tony and I. Mm-hmm. Tony's my roommate and a director. Mm-hmm. I was there supporting a short film that he had done called Found. It was his thesis project. I've got a tickle in my throat or something.
Are you allergic to cats?
Oh, you have cats.
I have a cat.
A cat.
That would be the problem. Sorry.
There you go.
Sorry. That's do you need a Zyrtec? I have Zyrtec.
No, I don't know. I think I'll be okay.
All right, let me know.
Yeah.
Because I have...
If I break down by the end... Maybe that's why we'll end early. It's because I'm dead. You have to cart me out something. So Tony and I then, I was a writer at the time. I had been previously, I was an actor, I was a director, and at that point, while we met, I was kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony was directing and still is directing. And after meeting you, we had already been working on a short script together. And this was a piece that I had written as a play first, and then we were turning it into a script. And it was zombie-esque film, and we then it was kind of dark and intense. And we thought, well, you know what a lot of people do is that they hire in a funny guy to play one of the dark and intense roles.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Tony and I, we were bouncing it back and forth, and we thought, you know what? We should reach out to Todd and see if he'd be interested in playing one of the roles in the film.
Right.
And also, you're a face. And we're like, oh, that would...
You know, I have a face, yes.
Raise our cachet a little bit. It's like nobody knows your name, but everybody recognizes your face.
Yeah, that guy's recognizable,
yes,
yeah.
They see, like, even on the back of the DVD cover now, people are like, oh, I know that guy.
Mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm.
is, oh, yeah, where from? I don't know.
I don't know. He looks familiar. I don't know.
But, we approached you to play one of the roles in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a interesting evening of drinking as well.
It was.
The Pineapple
Hill? Pineapple Hill Saloon, yeah.
Nice.
In Sherman Oaks there. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great place.
It was. I've been there a couple times. And, I have a good time.
It's a fun dive bar. I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after that meeting, I was like, I don't know. And Tony's like, oh, I think he's great.
I don't know.
But, so then we offered you the part.
Uh-huh.
And then we made script changes.
Uh-huh.
And you still seem to like the part after the script changes.
What were the script changes?
I don't remember.
Okay. No.
So, originally, it was just kind of a zombie-esque thriller thing, but neither one of us loved that concept. We were doing it. It had been a class assignment. I was taking an English class, and the professor said, so we're going to do a play.
Mm-hmm.
And she started taking suggestions from the classroom, you know, what all could the play be about? And so she's writing everything that they say, you know, apocalypse, okay, write it down. Zombies, write it down. Whatever anybody would shout out. And nobody was shouting out things to make it a good play. They were shouting out things to make their friends laugh.
Oh, all right, right.
But she's taking them all seriously, and she's writing everything down on the board. And so at some point in time, like, she knew that I had been in film and stuff like that. And she said, so she turns to me and she says, do you want to write it? And I said, write that? Because it was a mess. There was stuff from everywhere. And I said, no. And then I thought, well, maybe maybe I could do something with it. And so she says, I said, do I have to put all of that in there or can I throw some stuff away and whatever? And she's like, yeah, do whatever you want. Just kind of make sure everybody's heartbeat is in it.
Okay.
And so I was like, all right, cool. So I wrote this thing in I guess, a week, a short play. And then we read it in class, you know, like a staged reading, like cast the different parts and whatever. And so the everybody liked it. Everybody thought it was great. And then there was this film festival coming up, AOF, Action on Film. And I knew a lot of people that were going to be in AOF. And so I started adding up all the ticket prices if I was going to pay to go see everybody's movies. And then I thought, well, that's a lot more than the $40 it takes to submit a short film. Right. So I just took this short play that I had written and turned it into a short film in 3 days and submitted it to AOF just so I could get in there and see everybody's
movie.
Yeah. And it got in, which I was anticipating that it would, but it was also nominated for Best Sci-Fi Short and Best Dialogue. And wound up winning for Best Dialogue.
Well, congratulations.
And thank you. And that's the that's where I met Tony, is at that film festival.
Oh, okay.
And so we started working on the script, and basically it was just this zombie thing that I had to do for school. But it was after we met you, and we kept talking about it, and we really wanted it to be something more philosophical.
Right.
So the original script that we gave you was just kind of basic boilerplate thriller whatever.
Right. Know.
And then we went back and we put in some philosophical stuff and so we were concerned now that you had already signed on and now we've changed some stuff about your character.
Right.
Would you still be interested in the piece?
Right.
So from your perspective, how did that all... Do you remember any of those?
I honestly don't have any recollection of...
Changes or any of that kind of stuff.
I mean, well, every script that you get winds up being rewritten on some level. I don't remember feeling like the character was, like, altered to a great degree.
Cool.
Like, as far as what I wanted to do with it. It's, I mean, I did a Disney Channel show.
Yeah.
One of those tweener shows.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I auditioned for it, and they hired me. And then there was a table reading, and the Disney executives hated everything about this episode script. So overnight, the writing staff had to write a whole new script.
Wow.
They kept me... And my character name, but everything else about the character completely changed.
Wow.
It was completely different. And all the comedy that I had found that worked in the audition room and got me hired was gone. So I just spent the whole week going, I don't know, it was so stressful.
So it was no longer a comedy?
No, it was still a comedy, but it was just, like, the stuff that I latched onto comedically that made sense to me was removed and replaced with something that I wasn't latching onto comedically and I didn't quite understand.
Wow.
And, like, at one point, one of the producers in between the producer's run-through and the network run-through literally sat with me for about 45 minutes and gave me precise line readings.
Wow.
On every fucking sentence in the script. And I was just like, you know, I'm not the kind of actor who storms off of sets or curses people out or whatever. So I was just politely smiling and nodding and going, okay, okay. And then did my best to give him those line readings. But, I mean,
Wow. That's
just not something you should do to an actor.
It's not creative at all.
No. And it wasn't letting me find anything and figure it out. And it just was a really stressful week. But I don't remember feeling that way about Butterfly Dust at all.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, we tried to keep your character the same. Your character was the truth teller.
Right.
He was the one, the practical, you know, no emotion, we're just, this is what we have to do kind of guy.
Right.
And really, we added... Well, I guess we added a lot of the philosophy, we started trying to figure out how the arguments could be, like, who would be the mouthpiece for each side.
Right.
In this film, there's Barca Cosmetics is a cosmetics company, and they were doing human testing on test subjects in a lab, and everything was going great until it wasn't.
Right.
And then the test subjects turned zombie-like.
Right.
And so your character then would have the argument of, we need to preserve ourselves.
Right.
And the other characters would all take turns trying to do the other argument of, we need to be humanitarian. Mm-hmm. These were people. Mm-hmm. We're responsible for this change. Mm-hmm. And so there were better arguments, I think, is really what the changes turned into.
Right, right.
Which we both were happier with.
Right.
And we were happy that you were happy with it, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I loved about that character, because being a fan of the zombie genre, mm-hmm. it's like every new zombie movie is always reinventing the wheel, and it's... You know, it's always like they figure out all the same shit that the audience already know. You know, headshots take them down. That's what kills zombies. Right. Nothing else kills zombies. Right. And they always have to figure that out in the movies. And there's always, yes. You know, everybody's confused. So what I liked about that, the character of Albert, was here was a guy who was like immediately saying, without, I mean, I obviously didn't use the word zombies, but it was is immediately just saying, no, we're dealing with a zombie outbreak. It's not, you don't. Because in other movies, you know, it takes them a whole, like, half the movie to be like, well, wait a sec, what is this, you know, what's right. happening? And it's yes. like, this guy right out of the gate, it's like, we're fucked, this is a zombie situation. That's what I loved about that guy, this is a zombie situation. We can't, like, sit and try to, you know, nurse her and make her better, she's turning into a goddamn zombie. Yes. End of story.
Yes.
We gotta shoot her in the head. You know, and I like that. I thought that was kind of awesome.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So we've been dancing around this, but let me, I actually brought in a clip for the movie. And this kind of explains the setup. This is just about a minute, and this is majority of you, but other people are talking as well. So you'll hear a bunch of stuff. Anyway, hopefully this will be.
Where's Vicky?
They got her.
The test subjects have regressed.
They ripped her apart.
They had stabilized.
Changes, all the enhancements that we generated with Mariposa have somehow been reversed.
They were fine this morning.
What are you saying?
Their skin is green, their hair thin, their behavior is...
Fucking animals.
It's not their fault.
They attacked us at the launch pad.
You standing up for them?
They trusted us. It was our job to protect them, and we have a moral obligation to fix them.
We have an obligation to survive.
You selfish bastard.
Self-preservation is one of the basic traits of all living things. When Dex fired his gun, they continue to charge. They are no longer concerned with their survival. They are no longer human.
If they're no longer human, if they're monsters or animals, they are that way because of what we did to them.
You're so cute.
Damn.
Ladies and gentlemen, Todd Robert Anderson.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, I was immediately saying, they're fucking not human.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like that exchange.
Yeah,
that belittlement of the bleeding heart scientist there.
And the one who'd been picked on her whole life for being attractive.
Right, right. Oh, it's tough being beautiful, man.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So, we actually got a review as well. One.
Where?
For Butterfly Dust.
Where?
Were you not aware of this?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a review. And this is not even one that you pay for. A lot of short films, you know, they go out and they pay a couple people to review their film. This one just happened to naturally show up.
Oh, okay.
It's on some website.
They saw it at a film festival or?
I guess, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. But anyway, so... can we take a minute?
Yeah, I've not heard this review. I'm very excited. I hope it's not too harsh.
Well, no. I think you'd be fine.
I don't. Is this gotcha journalism? Am I about to?
Yes, absolutely. No, so we had been billing this as 12 Angry Men meets 28 Days Later. And he starts out with, the description of 12 Angry Men meets 28 Days Later is apt, but it's much more. It's a character study at times that considers the different ways in which rational people deal with threats to themselves and their friends. At other times, it's an action thriller. Now, this is written by Christopher J. Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on to compare it to another well-known zombie film. He says, did it remind me of World War Z, the movie, not the book? Yes, a bit. But it went beyond that level by working with its material so wisely.
Ah, wow.
Then he throws some people under the bus with a backhanded compliment. It didn't rely on complex cinematography or dazzling effects. But then he brings it home. He says, the script takes center stage in this fine short.
Oh, cool. That's nice.
Yes. Thank you, Uncle Garcia. I totally appreciate
it. Yeah, that's
that
nice.
He really wrote lots of nice things about my script.
And that's very
obviously
nice.
I'm not Garcia at all. I'm as white as the
colors. You're as white. So this is not a lie.
No, really not.
That's cool. I wonder where he saw it.
I don't know.
Do you guys have it up online somewhere now?
We don't. We should talk to Tony about that.
Yeah, you guys should put it up online.
But yeah, the blog, it's a blog, klaus@gunpointweebly.com.
Huh.
And if you go there, like all of your podcast listeners will go there, just scroll down to the bottom, and that's where you'll see the Butterfly Dust review.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I'm kind of sad that you didn't make the cut. I don't know why he didn't single out your performance,
because
I thought you were fantastic.
You know, it's funny. The funniest thing is people very rarely mention me in their reviews of things.
Really?
It's always been that way. Yeah.
Because they don't recognize you? I mean, like, oh, he's that guy, but I don't remember where I saw
him. I really don't know. I can't explain it. I mean, when I used to do theater all the time, you know, the reviewers would, whether it was, I mean, I guess it's a good thing, because if they were shitting on the play, they didn't mention me specifically. But if they were raving about it, they wouldn't mention me specifically either. It was like sometimes, like one of the only times that a theater reviewer is like, my Film Pigs stage show, the guy reviewed it, and we were doing a parody of Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And I, of course, played the Tom Hanks part with the shaky hand. And he was very, it was the funniest thing, he was very complimentary about the consistency of my shaking hand for the, you know, hour and 15 minute show.
Interesting.
And I was like, that's it? That's all you got, like, out of my comedic performance was that my hand was shaking the whole time?
Your hand was so funny.
It was hysterical.
Hysterical.
Yeah.
Now, I loved your performance all the way through. I thought that you did a great job of bringing that person into this world and really did. But I do, my biggest compliment to you was something that you did with your hand.
What was it?
So at the end of the movie.
I know what this is. Yeah.
The guy's passing out guns so that y'all can protect yourselves. And when you take the gun, it's heavier, like your character has never held a gun before.
Right.
And it's heavier than your character was anticipating.
Right.
And that moment was, even though it was rehearsed or done in your head beforehand or whatever, I don't know what you did, but in that moment, I learned so much about your character. And
right.
It was with your hands and not a line or anything.
That's true.
It was really good.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. I like that moment.
Yeah,
it was just a fun, great character to play. I really enjoyed it. That was one of two zombie short films I made that summer.
Yes, and the other one was supposed to play in the same block as Butterfly.
Oh, that's
Dust.
Right. And then there was
Dog
like
Catcher.
A technical follow-up, and then
something
didn't happen. That
in the
sucks.
Cincinnati Film Festival. Cincinnati,
that would have been so much fun. Yeah, I mean, I obviously wasn't there, but it would have been so cool if they'd played. And they were supposed
back
to play,
back.
Like, back-to-back
yeah.
in this block of shorts. That would have been hilarious. You know what? It would have been cool just to hear whether or not people realized. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, my look is pretty distinct, but I don't know. Maybe that people wouldn't have realized right away, or that
the face
is this
that
the same
see.
Guy?
They've got to be able to put that together, especially back to back in movies.
Yeah, but they're two totally different movies.
Yeah,
outside of the fact that they're short films and they involve zombies.
Yeah.
They're completely different.
Yeah.
And the guys I'm playing are completely different. Like, in Butterfly Dust, I'm, you know, an intelligent human being. Maybe I'm kind of a dick, but I'm intelligent and reasonable. you know, and I'm a dick about that, sure.
Right.
But then in the Dog Catchers, I'm a fucking lovable idiot.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a complete moron.
I never got to see it.
So, oh, yeah. Oh, you should watch it. I'll show it to you after we do it. I got a copy of it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Cool. I've seen the little trailer thing, and so I kind of have a sense as to what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's so, trailers of short films are so funny, because I'm like, this is like a 2-minute trailer for a 10-minute movie. Why not just fucking watch the movie?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Yeah, we had a good time working with you. Actually, the whole cast was great.
Cool. Everybody was cool, and the crew was cool, and everybody was super patient because, you know, it was a whole... We shot it over 2 days, or was it...
No, we were supposed to shoot for 4 days.
Uh-huh.
We had a day to set up, and then 4 days of shooting on the schedule.
Right. But there was a problem, and it wound up only being 3 days, right?
Yeah, 3.5, yeah.
And, like... So there's that time crunch, and we're shooting it in a loft, you know, near downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's fucking hot because it's summertime.
Yes.
It's filled with, you know, lights and shit that make it that much hotter.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a really tight, enclosed environment filled with all these friggin' people rubbing shoulders constantly.
Yeah.
Like... Everybody remained cool and patient and supportive of each other, as far as I could tell, anyway. And I thought that was kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Because in that environment, it would have been really easy for tensions to mount and people to lose patience.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm glad that we were able to keep the... all the shit that was going on behind the scenes away from the actors, which it sounds like we did.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, that's good. You coddled the actors, and that's what you need to do, because the actors are very sensitive. The other thing I remember about that set, when I first walked in, so you guys built this whole lab in this guy's apartment, and then there was, like, up on top of, like, a high, like, shelf in the wall or something, you know? There were, like, when I walked in, I looked up, and there were all these naked... mannequins.
Yeah.
And it was like really huge boobed. And I feel like, I can't quite remember, but I feel like maybe there was like an S&M-y vibe to them. And it was just weird.
It was.
And I was like, is that part of the set?
Nope.
You know? And
that's
everybody was like, nope, that's part of the apartment. And I was like, that's fucking weird.
Yeah.
That is a weird-ass choice.
Yes.
I mean, if you are a single dude, right, and you bring a woman home, and...
Yeah.
I mean, that could potentially be a deal-breaker.
Yeah, it could.
What's with the fucking creepy mannequins, dude? I'm out,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm gotta get out of here.
I guess, though, that could be a test, you know? If she freaks out about that, then she's gonna freak out about other things. I don't know. I'm just saying.
But if you have, like, weird mannequins like that, I'm just saying, it's kind of a serial killer vibe you're throwing out. I think a woman would be completely reasonable in going, what the fuck? What did I get myself into? I gotta get out of here, you know?
Funny. So, Tony, the director of Butterfly Dust and good friend of ours and roommate of mine, has a mannequin in his bedroom.
Does he really?
He does, yeah.
A big boobed
No, not man. Big boobed, just like a normal. So he
So
did
why
this.
Does he have a mannequin?
Well,
he
produced a music video for Lifehouse, the band.
Sure.
And the mannequin played an integral part. She had to look really like a woman.
Right.
And she was consequently very expensive. And so when the shooting wrapped for the music video, he just took her home.
Right.
And she stands in the corner of his bedroom, just like looking.
And, okay. Well, you know, there was a weird quality of these mannequins on that. In that apartment. This sounds like this is a movie-making memorabilia. That
yes, yeah.
I mean, there were several of those big-boobed mannequins up on the on that shelf. And I don't know.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird. Tony's thing doesn't feel weird. These did feel weird.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's absolutely. What I'm saying. I wasn't, you know, I didn't want to make, I don't want to make a blanket statement. About men.
Don't offend the mannequin community.
You know, I don't judge people for having mannequins in their homes, but, you know, these particular mannequins were really odd.
Unsettling.
They were really odd.
Yeah. So, yeah, one thing that Tony does, you talked about how everybody was easy to get along with and whatever, and that's one of the things that Tony does on his sets, is he makes sure, like, casting. We spent a long time casting, even though your role was already sealed and, one of the other roles was sealed in the first round of things. Then when we did callbacks, we played with the feel of the room.
Sure.
Brought in a bunch of different people to read with you and Kevin, to see who had the best fit and not just who could be best actors. 'Cause by that point we had, they were all going to be good actors.
Right, right.
It was all just chemistry in that room and who's going to bounce off of each other.
Well. Right, right.
So.
Yeah, I remember the audition process.
Yeah.
Because I was in there reading with everybody for a while. That was cool. I actually enjoyed that. Auditioning's not my favorite, but when you already have the part and you're just working with other actors, it's more fun.
Nice.
Although, you know, you feel bad for
people that don't,
people
get,
that
it.
Don't get it.
Because you like, made this connection.
But, yeah. Yeah, Tony does. I think that's really important to set that vibe. I mean, you know, I've worked in commercials for so many years, and there's, I mean, that's such a huge difference for me. And, but ultimately, you know, the product that is done, whether it doesn't really matter, I don't think. Because, you know, I've worked with some real assholes and, you know, it was perfectly fine what was ultimately produced.
Yeah.
But it's just, I hate working in environments like that.
Yeah.
I hate working in environments. And it really is the director, I think. You know, even in commercials where there's, like, such a long string of people who are, you know, there's so involved. Many cooks in that kitchen. There's, you know, the producers and the clients and you know. And the clients are telling the producers, and the producers are telling the director. The director's on commercials is sort of an ambassador, really, between the creatives and the, you know, people who are trying to sell something.
Right. Yeah.
But if the director, if the director's horrible, then everybody's horrible,
miserable,
and miserable, and you know. I mean, I worked with, you know, one of the most legendary assholes in commercials, and, like, his sets were no fun.
Wow.
I mean, everybody was miserable. And this guy was so successful. He won so many awards.
Yeah.
I think he actually won an Emmy for a commercial.
Wow.
Like, they gave him an Emmy for some kind of achievement, and it was for a commercial. But, like, you know, so he was, you know, really successful and rich and such an asshole.
But it seems like if you're going to make something and you can have fun doing it or you can be miserable doing it, it's like, why not be fun?
Right.
Why not have a good time?
Ironically, I did a Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial directed by David O. Russell.
Oh, yeah?
Who was perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah?
But he, like, just recently, he got in more trouble. Like, people, I can't remember, I think it was Christian Bale. Like, came out and said David O. Russell is an asshole, and he was abusive on set to Amy Adams on American Hustle.
Interesting.
Famously, George Clooney said, I'm never working with this guy.
Three Kings days and whatever, but I've seen interviews with, or been to Q&As with him, and he's like, I was an asshole back then, but I kind of, it was ego, it was all sorts of shit. I've got my... I'm centered now. I'm much better, and from I don't recall the Christian Bale thing.
But that was in the last couple of weeks, is what I'm telling you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he got in a lot of trouble because that video came out of him tearing apart a hot set because Lily Tomlin, him and Lily Tomlin started screaming at each other. And she walked up, and he's just started cursing her out and, like, breaking shit. Like, it was a hot set.
Yeah.
And he wrecked it.
Wow.
Like, threw a fit. You know, like that. There was that Dennis Quaid viral video that turned out to be fake.
Yeah.
But David O. Russell's was, like, was absolutely real.
I didn't see it.
It's probably still on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, there's so many, like, different versions of it up there. But then, like, he rehabilitated, you know, his anger, you know, management or whatever.
Yeah.
But then just recently, you know, all these people came out about American Hustle and, like, he was abusive to Amy
Adams. That's so weird because he's worked with a couple people recently, Bradley Cooper and...
Oh, that's who it was. It was Bradley Cooper, not Christian Bale. Sorry. Yeah, I can't remember. I don't know. I can't remember who
Cooper worked with him both in Silver Linings and then in
Right.
So I thought, oh, well, not only has he rehabilitated, but he's able to maintain relationships and...
Right. Well, I mean, Mark Wahlberg worked with him a couple of times, too. But, he's just got this reputation.
Yeah.
And you know, and I can't, it might have been Bradley Cooper, it might have been Christian Bale, one of the dudes, or maybe it was Jeremy Renner. I don't remember. It was one of those guys basically saying, he was abusive to Amy Adams, and they had to stick up for him, and this whole PR thing about him being rehabilitated is bullshit.
Wow.
So
I had no idea.
Me either. See? But then, you know, Jeremy Renner went and got himself in trouble, too.
And so, but you're saying that you were on a David O. Russell set for a KFC commercial?
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
And
he was totally cool to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem, and he didn't throw any fits, and he was really nice.
He didn't throw chicken at you?
He didn't throw chicken at me, and, you know... It could be a different thing, though, because he's working on a commercial and he doesn't give a shit about it creatively. He's doing this for money and he just wants to get through the day and, you know, go home.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might have been it. But, like, at one point, like, they had in the – it was actually a funny spot. But at one point, like, one of the bits that we had in the spot – like, it was for, like, a new chicken sandwich. So I'm – telling everybody, you know, to think little instead of think big. That's a joke. I'm like the boss in the office. And as I'm doing it, I'm taking bites of this chicken sandwich and I'm talking to everybody with my mouth full of sandwich, which is a very funny thing to do. Food is very funny.
Yeah.
Eating is funny. If it can be very funny.
Yeah.
Especially if your mouth is full and you're yelling at people. But at one point, you know, the client suddenly, like at the end of the day, like, you know, you have a spit bucket.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not swallowing every bite, but I am ingesting some of it. It's impossible not to.
Right.
And also, just, like, having that shit in your mouth, it starts to, like, feel like you're putting sand in your face or something. Yeah. It becomes kind of awful, and you have to pretend that it's not. And then the clients were like, yeah, you know, maybe could he swallow it? You know, on this take, like at the end of the day, they suddenly decided that, you know, maybe this comic bit of this guy talking with his mouth full wasn't, you know, good for the product.
They've seen it all day long and now they're tired of it or something.
In the clients in their mind, they're like, he needs to swallow it to show the audience that it's really delicious as opposed to just holding it in his mouth.
Yeah.
And David O. Russell came up to me and he's like, I'm sorry. Do you think you can swallow it? And I looked at him and I said, no, I cannot swallow it. We've been doing this for 10 hours.
Yeah.
And
and your mouth is coated with garbage
and it tastes awful.
Oh, wow.
And if I try to swallow it, it's going to look like I'm having a hard time swallowing it. And I was like, and besides, like, we established at the beginning of the day that it's funny to have me talk with my mouth full as opposed to bite and swallow and then talk, you know?
Right, yeah.
And he was like, yeah, I'm sorry. That's just what they want. And I was like, well, I mean, do you really need me to do this? And he's like, no. Like, he was concerned about me, and I'm not a movie star.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was protective of me, it felt. that was the experience I had with David O. Russell, which is nice. The complete opposite. But that happens, you know? Yeah. Like, people have reputations, then they have, maybe they usually have bad days, and then they have a good day. I mean, I, like, heard so many horrible stories about Richard Dreyfuss, and I have friends who've since, you know, worked with him, and they don't have nice stories about Richard Dreyfuss.
Huh.
He's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But I was working retail, and he came in with a bunch of Christmas presents that he wanted gift wrapped because I worked in, like, this gift shop. And he was the nicest fucking guy. He, like, hung out. We were talking. Like, I had to wrap all these gifts. He went and ran some more errands and then came back, and I'm still working on his gifts. And he stood around and talked, and, you know, we just talked about, you know, movies and all that stuff. And he was really nice. And then he tipped me $100. He gave me $100 bill and said, thanks, have a good holiday. I was like,
wow,
holy shit. I thought he was supposed to be an asshole.
Yeah.
And he totally was, you know, so I, you know, and it's like, you know, speaking of Christian Bale, like when he had that blow up on the Terminator thing,
yeah,
you know, screaming and the you know, the audio got out and it was made a big deal of. The guy was having a bad day. And he was working on a bad movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that.
I did, yes.
But I'm sure, and they were reshoots, so I'm sure he was like, God, I just want to put this behind me, and now I got to go and bring it for this crap that I don't even like. And I, you know, it's not professional, but if you're, you know, tired as fuck,
because
when you're working on those big features, you know, the days, you don't sleep.
Right, yeah.
You sleep for like 5 hours a night, you know? You have no life outside of that. I mean, I can get losing your shit.
Yeah.
I mean, I really can.
Yeah.
I've been crying. I mean, I got cranky on Fuzz Track City a couple times. Hick still gives me shit about it. And I'm like, I don't remember doing that. And he's like, yeah, you were being a total dick. And I was like, well, it was 1,000 degrees. And you had me in that fucking coat with that wig and everything. Shut up.
So I have another question. So this kind of takes us off in a slightly different direction, but I was an actor, I was a director, I was a writer, and now I've stepped out of the entertainment industry pretty much altogether. I might still help somebody with their project, but I'm not pursuing any of that myself.
Right.
I've moved on. And I want to know, for my own personal thing, I'm trying to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
You've been doing this for a long, long time. How do you know when it's your passion? When it's your... How do you know that this is the thing that you're supposed to be pursuing?
You mean just in general?
Yeah. Because, like, okay, so you hear this all the time. You know, follow your dreams, right? Follow your dreams. Follow your heart. Follow your... But have you seen American Idol? Like, there are some people that are just not talented.
Right, right.
So how do you know if it's, I'm talented, but this is not for me, or I'm just not talented, and I should really figure out something else to do with my life?
Well, you know, I remember I tweeted one time, I said, remember, follow your dreams, unless your dreams are fucking stupid. You know what I mean? So... I, you know, whenever people ask me about, because writing and directing, and those are different balls of wax, so I can't speak to that, really.
Yeah.
But as an actor, I always say the same thing to, like, young people who are like, how do you get into it, you know? And I'm like, first of all, I have no idea. There's no magic bullet. I can tell you how I got into it, and it's not going to make any sense to you, and it's not something that you'll be able to repeat because things are constantly changing, you know, technology and the business and the, you know, environment, you know, it's just, it's always different. So there's no good way to go about it, you know. It's just, if you really want to act, then just act, you know, and don't put pressure on yourself to, first of all, ask yourself, is there anything else in the world that I would be happy doing? So if acting is the only thing that you will be happy doing, then understand that you're probably going to spend your whole life broke, and you're going to be frustrated a lot, and you're going to be miserable. You know what I mean? So if there's something else that you're going to be happy doing, you should do that. But if this is the only thing, you know, if it really is the only thing, then understand all the cliches are true. It's a fucking hard business. And I mean, for me, you know, it's like, I've never been, you know, I don't have the career that I once envisioned myself having at all. To a lot of outsiders, it's like, if you say that, they're like, but you work and, you know,
TV.
You're on TV. You have you make money doing it and blah, blah, blah. And that's true, you know, but I make a very working class living at this. I don't, you know, you see the outside of my house. It's falling apart. I can't fix it because I don't, you know, it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I've never been like a series regular on a TV show.
Yeah.
And the truth is time has gone on. I get paid less and less money for more and more work because that's just the way the business has changed.
It doesn't have anything to do with you or your age or any of that kind of stuff. It's just,
there's age issues. Sure. But I'm a man. It's right. Way worse for a woman.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, corporations are always trying to cut corners and pay people less.
Yeah.
You know, so when I started, you know, if you got a guest star role, you know, a top of show guest star role, that was like 5 to 10 days of work, you know. But now they'll schedule it so they can shoot you out in a day.
Wow.
You know, and pay you a lot less
as
a result. I mean, like, I did an episode of Hawaii Five-0 a couple months ago. And that was the first time in years that I've gotten that kind of guest star role, and then actually, you know, had a week of work and got paid for it.
In Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So now
I made more off of that one episode than I did my entire 3 episodes of Weeds.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, is that because it's Weeds versus HBO, I mean, it's versus CBS, or
that's part of it. Like, the big networks just pay more,
yeah,
and Showtime is notoriously cheap, and Lionsgate is notoriously cheap, and it was a Showtime show produced by Lionsgate, but the way they get around, you know, those union rules is to make you a one-day guest star instead of a guest star, even though you might be in multiple scenes, but they'll just shoot all your scenes in one day.
So did they shoot you one day for the stuff on Weeds?
I worked in a 3 days.
3 days.
It was 3 episodes. It might have been 4 days. I mean, I loved working on it. It was great.
Yeah.
You know, and my friend who is the showrunner on a show that I have a recurring role on now. You know, it was awesome to sit on a set with my buddy.
Yeah.
And it was a funny show. So, I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, so often I wind up, you know, Fuzz Track City, Butterfly Dust, I do something that I'm just passionate about and isn't something that I would normally get to do because, you know, the business doesn't see me that way or whatever. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think that's when the art comes into it, and it's not just craftsmanship. Is when you do, and you have to do that.
How do you define success?
Well, that's changed so much for me over the years.
Yeah.
Because I don't define it monetarily, really.
Yeah.
I just define it as walking away from whatever I'm doing, whether it's a passion project that I'm not getting paid for or something that I'm getting paid for, just, you know, by, you know, just doing a good job, you know.
Yeah.
So you feel like
you're successful if you've accomplished in that project what you
thought
you were
supposed to. If I served the story, then that's a success for me.
Cool.
You know, and whether I get paid or not is sort of beside the point. Actually, I just read an interview with Tom Hardy where he said that. He said, the truth is, I mean, I love that I'm getting paid a lot of money for this, but the truth is if I wasn't getting paid, I'd still be doing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, I, you know, an actor acts. Earlier. Yeah. If I'm not sure if that, when I said that, it recorded because we had a technical hiccup, but you may be referencing something that people are like, I don't know what he's talking about.
But no, when you said that if you can be happy doing anything else, you should do it.
Yeah.
Well, in Tom Hardy's case, it sounds like he wouldn't be happy doing anything else, and he would continue to do this whether he was getting paid or not.
That's exactly, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
There was a quote that I got about that. How do you define success? From Maya Angelou. Success is liking yourself, liking what you do, and liking how you do it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I would say that's pretty true, although acting is a little bit tricky, the liking how you do it thing. You know, it's funny because, you know, like I did that episode of Hawaii Five-0 a couple months ago, and it felt good in the doing of it. And then when I watched myself, I hated myself.
Really?
Yeah, I was like, oh, could have done that so much better. But that's what... I think it was Uta Hagen who described that as the divine dissatisfaction of being an actor.
I saw parts of it. I didn't see the whole episode, but Tony had recorded it and showed me your parts. So it looked like you've got the part where you're sad, I can't believe that this all happened, and then the part where, spoiler alert, you're confessing to, because you got scratches on your arms.
Right, that I'm actually the horrible, horrible murderer.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, which of the two scenes were you dissatisfied with, or was it both of them, or?
Well, I was dissatisfied more with the emotional, sad scene.
Yeah?
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, it's like, when you're doing those kind of procedural shows, one, I think it's the hardest gig an actor can get, where you have to be emotional, because somebody you love is dying or dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you're delivering very expository dialogue.
Yeah.
And it's always awkward, you know?
Yeah.
And I've always, I mean, I was really happy to have the chance to do that, because usually when I do, you know, hour longs, I'm just like a comic relief. I'm a goof in scene or two. So in this, I, you know, wasn't. So that was a great opportunity. And to have that challenge, which it really was a challenge.
Yeah.
To deliver that stuff while remaining truthfully emotional, because you know, I don't know, maybe that does happen
for an
in
entire
real
day,
real life,
take after take after take after.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Alex O'Loughlin was a good host as the lead actor, and, you know. But at one point, the director said, "So you know, when we turn around on those guys, you know, you can kind of half the performance so we don't blow it all." And I was like, okay. And then when they moved the camera around, he was like, yeah, you're gonna have to come in hot on this too, sorry, because it was like dirty enough that they would see enough that I couldn't, you know, phone it in you know, off camera. So, and then there was a fucking helicopter, like, right before their call and action on, you know, some of my, you know, close-ups, there's a freaking helicopter. And so I'm like in that emotional place waiting for action while this helicopter circled over. I was like, Jesus Christ, really?
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, the other scene, you know, I liked a lot better, but that was the scene that I definitely latched on to in the audition was this, because it's just fun yelling at those cops, you know, giving them the shit. You know?
I actually thought that you did well in the sad scene, too. There was a little catch in your voice that kept coming out. I mean, there was some...
There was more... You know, it's funny. You never know what they're going to edit, what they're going to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were takes where there was even more of that emotion. But then, you know, at the end, it was just a wide shot. So... That's where it really kind of, I really got upset at the end there.
Yeah.
But they didn't use any of the close-ups, so I was a little disappointed about that. But
so, to be clear, you were hard on yourself. You thought, oh, well, I could have done a better job as an actor. But were you also then somewhat miffed at the... At the editing of the thing, were you there was better stuff there that you could have used.
Yeah, no, I know. Because, I mean, it's like, again, it's like, that was the, ultimately that shot, you know, where you're not seeing the fantastic acting that I thought I had done, it's better for the show. It's better.
Yeah.
You know, it's just better.
Yeah.
So no, I'm not mad at the way they're, I'm sort of, you know, part of me is like, well, it would have been nice to have seen that stuff. But,
yeah.
You know, in the end, it's about the story.
Nice. You know?
So no, I didn't get mad. But I also like, sometimes if I watch something again, then I'm like, oh, it's not as bad as I felt like it was. Usually when I watch myself the first time, I'm always like,
What did you think of Butterfly Dust when you watched it?
I liked it. There were things that I would have changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's like one of those things you just go, ah, you forgive yourself ultimately for that.
And then, so you've shown it to several people or whatever, and you've seen it now several times.
Yeah.
Do you like your performance better, or do
yeah,
you just accept it?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
more what it is?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do like some of the stuff I did, but other things, and I'm like, ah, you know, whatever. Because, yeah. I mean, it's like, I work without thinking too much about how I look. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Because I think some actors are way more aware of the camera and
yeah.
where they are and how it's looking and making sure it looks a certain way.
Yeah.
But I don't... I find that gets me too in my head.
Yeah.
I can't think
you need
of that.
To be
yeah.
there doing
if a director tells me, hey, do this or that, you know, then I can employ that. But I can't think of it on my own. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, my rule of thumb is if I'm not getting the adjustments, then I'm doing fine.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
So my last question then for today is, do you consider yourself successful?
Some days.
Yeah? Yeah. So it's a day by day thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's really funny. Like lately people have been seeing me on TV a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, things are incredibly slow, yeah. and I'm not going out on a lot of auditions.
Yeah.
So I'm like...
Is there a bigger picture, like the helicopter shot, as like you look down on your life?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm all right. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
I mean, I'm kind of a mess, but I'm all right.
I think you're pretty great.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Sure.
And once you get to middle age, you're suddenly all that stuff about success, you know, and
different
perceived success, and it's all like, it doesn't seem that important anymore.
But I think your
definitions
of success change.
Like, oh yeah.
Okay. So I'm happily married. I've got a kid. I've you know all that kind of stuff. I've got a roof over the head. So yes, that is a level of success, and that is a level that I've achieved, and I'm happy with that. So yeah, that's a successful life. Or, you know, the house isn't big enough, the wife is now fat, and the kid's on drugs, and so no, it's not success, because I wanted to have more. I'm still holding on to that vision of
right.
what I thought things were supposed to be like, or, you know.
Right,
whatever.
Right, right. So. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I know that some of my friends who are older, you know, in their 60s, will, you know, say that once you get... Like, you cross... Once you get over 40, you really become actually aware of your mortality, whereas before it's like...
Yeah.
Maybe I won't die.
Yeah.
And then it just, all that stuff, you know, money and all that, it does seem less important. It's still something you have to hassle with, but it's not the end all be all of everything. And my friends who are, you know, in their 60s and 70s always say, you know, once you get to my age, it's just, you realize, this is all there is. It's, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what I was so freaked out about. It's just, this is life. It's what it is, you know? It's not really that complicated. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think when you're younger, it seems more complicated.
I think it does. Well, thank you very much, Todd, for coming on my podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You're a great guest.
Oh, thanks. You're a great host.
The best guest I've ever had on this podcast.
Well, that's saying nothing.
But I said it so well.
You did. It was nice.